Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots.
Oh, goodness.
Jeez Louise, sip.
Oh, soup.
Oh, no.
Soup has heard what the subject of today's episode is, and he thinks he should be involved. You think you should be involved?
You need to get a second cat.
We do.
And you need to call it Baxter.
The thing is, I like it as a name, but I feel like it's more of a dog name. I feel like Baxter is like a dog.
But it could be like, you know, when sometimes they call a kitten Rex.
I mean, we are thinking of dragons. We have dragon soup.
Okay.
But
different worlds.
Yeah. But no, the list of potential kitten names reads like a shopping list. It's quite funny.
Yeah.
It's like egg, butter.
Egg.
Duck.
Lindsay.
Egg is cute.
Come here. And you imagine being a... Actually, you don't walk,
I don't...
You don't
that's the thing with
cats.
A cat. You don't have to like call it in the park.
See, I have to be like... I'm in my head, I'm like, egg. Come back here, egg. Or when every time someone's like, oh, what's this? What's their name? How old are they? And you're like, this egg. Is egg.
I think that would be funny. The people would love it.
Okay. But this does bring us to today's topic.
Yes.
Because we are, in a way, talking about soup. And as we've already alluded, we're talking about Baxter's.
Baxter's, yes. A brand that... So it's a brand and a topic that are quite close to my heart. Because, as we know, I grew up in Aberdeenshire. And we used to spend quite a lot of time on the Moray Coast when I was little. Up in Fintorn. And on the way to Fintorn, you drive through Fockabers, which is where Baxter's was founded. And where the sort of... shop and village you speak. Now, I didn't realise this until I was doing research for this episode. It sadly shut down, but they used to have like a Baxter's Heritage Village.
Oh.
It was like a sort of, you could go into the old grocer and the old shop. So this is what I used to go to. And there was this amazing restaurant where they served pancakes that were like the size of your head.
This was cut out of an earlier episode.
Yeah.
The episode about Florence.
Ah.
Where we were talking about because Florence's mum...
Mm-hmm.
was from Fockabers.
Yes.
And then you spoke, you waxed lyrical
about
as they
these
would say,
pancakes.
About these pancakes in
like,
Baxter's restaurant.
They're genuinely like imbued in my psyche as a child. Like, used to go, they were about the size of the plate. They were big, like drop scones, like a Scotch pancake, but huge. And you would get them with like cinnamon apples and ice cream on top.
Yeah, very American.
Very American.
But then we had that discussion that actually it might be a tourist trap because. Mm-hmm. Lots of Americans know the name Baxter's because of the global success of the Baxter's company.
Exactly.
And would be coming here for a trip and showing them some good old American hospitality.
And if you're up in Speyside, you're doing whiskey tours, you're going to the distilleries, you might want to go and see. Anyway, sadly, I don't think the restaurant's there anymore. I think it was a pandemic casualty. But Baxter's, as we know, is still an incredibly successful Scottish company. So we're going to be speaking about the family on the episode, about the history, how the brand made itself what it is today. But for those of you who have been living under a rock, Baxter's is it's famous for its jams and its soups. It's sort of a preserved food company.
Yeah.
Very big Scottish brand, big all over the world. And yeah, that's what we're going to be talking about.
It's our Heinz.
Yes,
it's our Hellman's.
Yeah.
It's our Hamburger Helper. every country around the world has a hero pantry staple.
Yeah.
And for us,
it's Baxter's. And I have to say, I was like looking at the website as I was doing my research, and they do these hampers, and oh my God, if anyone ever wants to buy me a ridiculous present, a wee Baxter's hamper would.
What is it just, is it tins and products and jams and jellies?
I mean, there's different levels of, you could get the Balmoral for a cool £250.
Easy.
Which involves some nice champagne and some whiskey, but also, all your jams, curds, your like pickles, soups, crackers, the whole shebang. I also love, I have a real weakness for tiny jars of jam. And working in academia, you're quite often at conferences where they'll have like scones with tiny jars of jam, and they do the tiny jars. So I quite often shove them in my backpack.
This is for Crime Stoppers. If
you see Dr. Middleton jangling and she goes past, check her pockets for jam. But yes, so I thought it would be good to begin, also selfishly, because it's one of my favourite research topics, with a brief history about tinned foods.
Oh, please. And I will, like, dear listeners, Lindsay has been waiting for this episode. You will, like, I'm going to provide commentary and question today. This is Lindsay's episode, because Lindsay is the queen of the tins.
I love tins. I love tins so much. They're so interesting. Yeah, the history of tins. This is not all going to be about the history of tins, but we will segue from tins into Baxter's eventually.
Please.
But yeah, so, and also not to flex, but I've got my like master...
You've got your thesis.
I've got my thesis for reference.
Okay.
Which I really need to actually like do something with, so it's not just in this ring-bound ridiculousness. But I don't know how much you know about the history of tins, Peter. Probably a lot, given that you've been my friend for a couple of years.
Everything I've learned about tins, I've learned through you. through canned osmosis.
Ah, love. They're fascinating. So basically, tins are... I mean, as a historian of food, and just as a historian generally, I don't like saying anything is an invention. Nothing is an invention. Everything is like a derivative of something that's come before. But tins were an innovation that came from what now, and if you were North American, you would call canning, and you still do call canning, which was when you put something in a jar, seal it, and then you boil the jar, and the act of boiling the jar seals it in there.
Yep.
So quite often you would do it with fruits, jams, etc. What happened, so this was invented in the late 18th century by a Frenchman.
The 1700s.
Yes, the 1700s, late 18th century, called Nicolas Appert, and he invented the technique, realised that it would seal the food. And what we as Brits, and I'm lumping us all together here, what we as Brits did is we stole it.
Of course.
Classic imperial behaviour. Anyway, two inventors... called Donkin and Hall had seen this technique and thought, actually, what would be more durable is to not have it in a glass bottle, but have it in a tin-coated iron canister. So one of them already had an ironworks, and in 1813, they'd established a factory in Bermondsey outside of London where they'd started tinning foods in metal tins. So start of the 19th century now, and this is when the tinned food movement begins. And it was very much initially in response to the Navy wanting better provisions.
Like, having done a couple of research bits about war and food in wartime, there is nothing that motivates food invention like global catastrophe.
It's crazy, isn't it? And I feel like tins are often at these points of conflict, like even today. I don't think we knew each other when the pandemic kicked off.
No.
But like sales of tinned foods went up by something like 300%.
Yeah.
Because people again started panic buying and like wanting longevity on their shelves. Obviously supply chains were really ruined for a bit.
I mean, this is not a point to go into like a personal soliloquy about my working class upbringing, as I often do.
Take the stage.
But tins were such a, like, the number of tins we had in the cupboard was equal to like the happiness we felt in the home. And that, like, it's like sometimes when you're living with food insecurity and you don't know where the meals are coming from by the end of the week.
Yeah.
Knowing you have 32 tins of whatever you've got in your cupboard means whatever happens, we have food.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of like relief that fresh food cannot afford you.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's reliable and it's there and it's like tangible and you can depend on it. And I think there is a snobbery around tinned foods, which comes from like classed outlooks on things. But which very much was born in the 19th century. So we have, for the first like 50 years, say, of tins being around in Britain, they're mainly being used by the Navy. And the people who are selling them are doing a really great job of being like, oh yes, the King loved it. And this tin went to the Arctic and came back and it was all fine. And Queen Victoria loves this kind of tin. And then you get to like 1850 and they're trying to break into the domestic marketplace. They're like going to exhibitions. They're showing people how to cook tinned foods. Because that was the other thing. If you have a tinned vegetable or a tinned meat, it's already cooked. Like you don't really get a tinned raw ingredient. So people didn't know how to cook with them. And initially, you know, you look at this kind of Navy advertisements for the first catalogs of tinned foods, and you did get things like stews and soups. But a lot of the time it was just one ingredient. It was like tinned mutton or tinned beef. So people didn't know how to do it. Anyway, you're at these exhibitions. People are being shown how to use them. They're being told that this tin's been to the Arctic and back, and we're going to open it in front of you. And look, it's still perfectly preserved. Yeah. And do you want to taste it? So it's all the showmanship. Then we have a couple of massive scandals which really put the public off of tinned foods. But they're a really interesting symbol of like how industrialization and mechanization and population expansion changed drastically the way we had to eat. Mm. So over the Victorian period, you've got cities rapidly expanding. You know, our population increases. I don't know the exact figures off the top of my head, but increases a lot. And we all of a sudden don't have enough food in Britain to feed our people anymore. So tins were a way of, this was before freezing was a thing that you could do in a great, on a grand scale. It was before steamships. It was a way that you could take meat from a cow or a sheep in Australia to Britain to feed someone.
Mm.
So it was this kind of amazing innovation, but there was still a lot of suspicion around it.
I suppose if you think about it at the time, most people are used to seeing the food that they are going to eat.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're also used to eating, obviously there was fast food, there were pie shops, there were things like that. But if you were buying food that you were going to prepare in the home, you weren't necessarily buying pre-made,
no, ready exactly. I think you might, you might buy sausages, but that was probably as similar as it got.
Yeah.
Whereas this was asking you to go to a grocer. Until like the 1860s, 70s, tins didn't have any kind of like decoration either. You couldn't see what was in the tin.
How miserly.
I know. So you would go, and apparently they had like blue or white labels, but there was no like pictures, there was no real descriptions. Also, initially tins were huge. They were massive. So you would be getting like, I don't know, 2 kilograms of tinned mutton, which was obviously too much for anyone. So you would be going to the grocer to get like a slice of this stuff.
Mm.
And the recipes for it are fascinating because it's like, oh, tinned meat casserole or tinned meat shepherd's pie. It's like make the whole recipe as you normally would, but then put the meat in for 10 minutes at the end to warm it. Because if you cooked a shepherd's pie the way you would if you had raw mince, you'd end up with absolute mush by the end. So it's a really interesting example of people having to like grapple with the way technology has changed what food not only looks like, but tastes like, feels like, smells like. You couldn't. It was like, you know, if you were used to going to a butcher and being able to appraise with your senses whether a bit of meat was fresh or not, to then going blind into strange cooked meat. And I don't know if you've ever seen some of the advertisements against tinned foods in the 19th century, but they're so funny. And you have like people opening tins and all these like rotten animals are jumping out, and there was like big suspicion about what was in these tins.
Yeah.
You know, because it could have been anything. So we have a really interesting time over the Victorian period, the long 19th century, from like 1810 to maybe the start of the First World War, where people are taking up tins, but pretty slowly and with a lot of suspicion. Now, around the sort of 1860s, there's a bit more tins start entering leisure markets. Mm-hmm. So places like Fortnum and Mason's would put them in their hampers. You could get your luxury tinned truffled pheasant. So if you're spending lots of money on your tin, you could get your tinned turtle to make your turtle soup. But for the more working class or lower middle class people, tins are pretty unappetizing. So it's not really until the sort of late 1800s that tinned foods are becoming more gradually accepted and more readily available and cheaper, but good tinned foods, not suspicious weird tinned mutton. And it's companies like Baxter's that are playing a big part in that.
Well, let's take a break.
Back into it, back into Baxter's. Mm-hmm. And I think we left off in the 19th century with a sort of my potted history, if you'll pardon the pun, of tinned foods, where people are struggling to sort of really jump on board. Some people are suspicious. Some people are really loving it. We have all these agendas around tinned foods, which makes them quite a contentious topic.
Where are those agendas coming from?
So there are people who are really suspicious. Basically, in 1852, there was this big scandal where they'd opened a whole bunch of tins in Portsmouth that were destined to be on Navy boats. And I think they opened... Oh, this is still in my brain. I'll be amazed. But it's not. They opened around 700 tins.
Okay.
And I think less than 200 were okay to eat.
Right, okay.
They'd all gone rancid. And this hit the press, and it was like a huge scandal. Everyone was raging because these were meant to be foods that were feeding our boys abroad and they're fighting our battles, blah, 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 blah. And that really turned suspicion onto tinned foods because it was like, okay, what's in there? You need to remember that people didn't actually understand the science behind tinning at that point because bacteriology was not a science yet. So we didn't understand bacteria as we do today. And instead of, the thought was if you let air into the tin, it would ruin. But actually what was happening was these tins of meat were so big that when they were boiling, they weren't necessarily always heating all the meat all the way through. So then you'd get this like raw meat in the middle that would go rancid, spoil the rest of the thing. So you have this point in the 1850s where, and the press reports on this were crazy. They were using all this like gothic language. They were saying that tin foods it must have killed Franklin because Franklin's missing at this point. And so Franklin, the Arctic explorer, some of the bodies of his crew have been found and they're like, it's the tins. I don't know if you watched The Terror.
No, it doesn't.
I actually also haven't watched The Terror. I need to, which is ridiculous. But every time I tell someone what my research is, they're like, oh, you must have watched The Terror. I'm like, no. But anyway, it was The Tins.
My 2025 brain asks, who was in charge of the newspapers?
So.
And were there pals like big farming folk?
No, it wasn't that. It was more that by this point, big tinned food manufacturers were not in Britain.
Right.
So a lot of them were based in places like what is Moldova, as it was then called.
Okay.
And it was very easy to have sometimes quite anti-Semitic, like, hatred of people who were creating these tinned foods. There was a very easy, like, them and us narrative.
Were they Jewish?
One guy in particular, Stephen Goldner, was.
Right, okay.
And it was his tins that had been... the ones that they'd opened, his tins had been on pot.
This makes so much more sense now.
Yeah.
19th century Britain, anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
I'm there. Okay.
Rife.
I'm on board.
So.
Not with anti-Semitism.
Not on board with anti-Semitism. And hopefully not on board a ship with these tins because you might not have been having a good time. But
14 halves of a cow in one wee tin. What happens?
Yeah. So we have a public that's very suspicious of things. At the same time, we have. Particularly like politicians and learned men of science as they went by in the 19th century saying, this is the solution to our problems. We can't feed our population. Mm-hmm. So if we can import meat from South America and Australia, where there's huge flocks of sheep and cattle, and historically there was big like tanneries and industries around the skin and the hides of these animals, but there wasn't the infrastructure to create meat markets. So all this meat was rotting. Right, so it was like, tin the meat, bring it here. And it's amazing. In Victorian cookbooks, it's called Australian meat or Australian mutton. That is synonymous with it's come from a tin.
Right, okay.
So it's basically like a worry about foreignness, but also like a recognition that we can't feed our population anymore. People are... navigating around the same narratives and they're either on one side or the other, but they're like playing each other against each other. So Baxter's begins in the 1860s, and this was a point at which we're in the height of all this strange debate around tin foods, and they didn't begin with tinning. They began with like jams and preserves. But what I found really interesting was the first Baxter who kind of makes the company what it was a man called George.
Yeah.
And he is quite comparable, I think, to Cranston or Tunnocks, and in terms of like the family dynasty that he begins. Mm-hmm. But it's quite an interesting counterpoint, because we've previously spoken about these families that were based in cities and they were using the infrastructure around them to kind of make themselves part of the town.
Yeah.
Whereas this, the Baxter story, is a very, very rural story.
Yeah.
So it's quite different from what we've considered before. And George, he was the gardener for the Duke of Richmond, or the Duke of Richmond and Gordon. I don't know if they were combined, but he worked on the Gordon estate.
Right, okay.
And he was the gardener. This is in Speyside, near Fockabers, where they then go on to establish Baxter's as a company. But I love this particular point because this was one of the oldest and sort of largest walled gardens in Britain that this family had. So George was clearly a gardener that was dealing with orchards, fruit bushes. This, like, a walled garden in particular is specifically designed to have, like, south-facing walls so you can grow fruit. Yeah. You might have had vines, you might have had an orangery. So he's in this place, a garden's already 200 years old.
Yeah.
And that's where he's working.
And I was going to say, I mean, actually, but walled garden culture in the 19th century is very much displays of wealth, displays of exoticism.
Yeah.
About either where you have traveled, where your friends have traveled and brought you.
Yeah, what tree they brought you back. Yeah, exactly.
It's all very much, you will have had access to fruits and vegetables that you might not see anywhere else.
Exactly. And they were all going into, when you look at the recipe books from these, like, large families.
Yeah.
Centuries before they were in mainstream, like, consumption, these families had access to quinces and, you know, grapes and all these things, because you could bring the plants back, you had the space, you had the infrastructure to grow them.
Yeah. I will say my granddad started a grapevine in his Paisley greenhouse, and it's
successful.
It's still alive today.
Amazing.
I mean, the worst grapes you will ever have, because the grapes from the 80s or the 70s, whenever he started that vine, were 90% seed.
Right.
But
it's there.
I do have, like, a wee, like, I wonder if we could ever get one bottle of wine out of...
One tiny wee,
a Gilchrist
like,
Reserve. Half.
Yeah. Love.
So I try not to do any research on Baxters and tins, because this is your baby. But I did have a wee look into George Baxter.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that we have seen happen, which we have seen in lots of the stories we have told, is that George's mum passed away when he was 2.
Ah, interesting.
And so obviously the small family from Moray was where they were staying. That's where George was born. And 2 years later, his mum dies.
Wow.
And then we don't see a lot in his life until he gets married in 1876. Mm. In between there is when he sets up, obviously.
Exactly.
This grocer's.
So he leaves his employ at the gardens in 1868, and you can tell that things are probably bubbling away and that he's not, I don't know whether he was dissatisfied, but he wanted to do his own thing. And he opened up his grocery store to begin with in the town of Fockabers. And just as a side note, Fockabers is such a good Scottish town name.
Oh.
It hits all the good noises.
It almost sounds rude, but
it does
not
sound rude. You're like,
what the fuck about?
Like, pardon me? Like, excuse me? But so good. And it was his wife, Margaret, who at the time when they were setting up the grocery store, she was the one that would make the jams and jellies for the local fruits. And apparently these were already very popular. The Duke, who they had these connections with because of George's employ with the Duke previously, was a big fan.
Right.
And it was those, like, jams and preserves from, I don't know whether they were using the Duke's produce. That would be a fun little...
Well, because in my head I'm thinking, where's the nearest port town? But I suppose Aberdeen is
Aberdeen, you've got, like, the Black Isle. You're not overly far from Inverness there, but, like, I'm thinking it's probably more locally sourced than that, rather than, like, getting things, you know, certainly with the fruits, you would have been importing the sugar, obviously, but... So we've got this business. It's come from the garden of the Duke. There's now a greengrocer set up in Fockabers. They're making jams. They're making jellies. I think it's still fairly low-key.
Well, I had a wee look into the British newspaper archive and to see where are the first mentions of Baxters that we have. Again, Baxter as a name exists without...
I was having such a hard time wading through articles.
All of the Baxters, but... I did actually, when I put in George Baxter and I went back as far as I could go, I went back to 1881, and we have an advert from George Baxter & Co. of Fockabers, And they've got a list of the preserved meats and fruits, etc., etc.
Love that. But two et ceteras. One's not enough.
Well, it's an ampersand and a C, which I'm assuming means et cetera. Yeah, it does. Yeah. So let me read out the list of preserved meats and fruits. Again, no mention of tins.
No, it probably wouldn't have been at this point.
But so corned beef, roast beef, minced collops. Minced collops are like a hamburger, like hamburgers, Jesus.
It reminds me of like a beef olive.
Yeah.
Like a sort of a quenelle of yes. meat.
But a minced collop is much closer to like a beef burger, mm-hmm. what we would might have. Lunch tongue, roast turkey, roast chicken, tripe, Irish stew. And then we have pineapples, salmon, mushroom, rabbit, lobster. And we do have soups, all sorts.
All sorts of soups.
They do have tinned milk, which I'm assuming really is evaporated milk.
Probably, yeah, yeah. Like condensed
milk. And we do have bottles of relishes and capers and things like that. It was an interesting read the rest of the article, the rest of the advertisement, because orders from the country punctually attended to and sent carriage, paid per carrier, bus or rail.
Mm.
So they're ordering in things mm-hmm. from George Baxter and Co. Price list of wines, spirits on the application, also wholesale catalogue to trade only. So people are ordering in from George Baxter outside of Fockabers.
Yep.
He's sending things by rail, mm-hmm. by train.
A wee bus, yeah.
By paid carrier on a carriage. Like, mm-hmm. And this is where I think we're maybe beginning to see some of that, like the Victorian notions of the quaint Scottish countryside.
Yeah.
Is maybe where they're beginning to market on mm-hmm. here. Because ordering in your tinned pineapples and bottled capers from the countryside and ordering them in such quantities that you're going to send a carriage
exactly
to take it yeah. to a train station to bring it to you, or shops, these new kind of grocery shops that are opening up across Scotland are going to be ordering in from George Baxter.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a really interesting transport link there and making it a selling point that people were doing like wholesale orders is crazy at that time. But yeah. I think it does speak to, particularly in Scotland, you know, I think there are maybe like four or five, like big preserved food companies that were operating on this scale.
Yeah.
And Baxter's really gets in there as one of them. It's interesting also to think of where it is in the country. Like, have you ever been to Fockabers? Or like Nairn or Moray?
Yeah, I mean, I do quite a bit of travel. I used to do quite a bit of travelling between Inverness and Aberdeen.
Mm.
So you were just on that top rail line going through.
Yeah.
We were in like a camping and National Trust family.
Nice.
So every weekend it was a let's pack up the car.
Yep.
With the muddy smelling tent.
Love.
Go somewhere that might have. So there was a lot of time spent in the Highlands and Islands because it's crawling with big empty houses that we would go walk around.
Love that. No, I mean, we're much the same, but I feel like it's not like aside from the whiskey, like Speyside is obviously a huge industry, but it's a part of the country that's a bit of an in-between.
Yeah.
You do, you're in transit through it rather than like, and no offense, I love Moray, like spent a lot of my childhood in Findhorn, but yeah, it is just like imagining this hub of industry that they're sending food all over Britain is like really interesting from that particular like geographical point. But yes, so as with other families that we have looked at, particularly Tunnocks, Baxter's is very much a generational thing. So George had a son called William.
Yeah.
And it was William who opened the actual Baxter's factory. So this was like an upscaling of the previous grocer business.
Do you know when that was?
In the early 1900s.
Right, okay.
So again, quite early, like for this sort of thing.
Well, I'm thinking, obviously, George is well established promoting his wares
mm-hmm.
for national travel
mm-hmm.
in the 1880s. So it's not an aggressive industrial growth.
No.
If they're waiting 20 years to move from a grocer, probably with a shop unit where they're creating or maybe kind of slowly building, and then it actually takes in excess of 20, 30 years to then move to a factory. Yeah.
So, and not only did they move to it, but they built it. Wow. So And interestingly enough, in the nice like circle of life bit, bought land off the Duke that William's father had Lovely. Worked for to set up the factory. So this was very close to the River Spey. Again, we're just off of Fockburs and the actual factory is still there today. But what I find interesting about William was it was his wife who, we have this story, we've had it before. The men are kind of running the factory. They're keeping up the family business. And then the wives come on board and they're like, let's mix things up.
Yeah.
So his wife was a woman called Ethel. And it was her, you know, she widened the range of jams that they were selling. She like did different flavors. But she was the first person to actually buy or like hire in a machine that would allow them to do like industrial scale tinning.
Right. Okay.
And I think in terms of like the preserves and the jams, they would have all still been canned as in jars. But what changes at this point is their ability to really expand the making of soups and things right. like that. So you can see the range really expands at that point. They start doing like fruits in syrup. That was one of the first places that did that rather than like a jam. It was mm-hmm. like, oh, you could get your, I don't know, pineapple in syrup or mandarin or peach or pears in syrup. But what also happened was in the 1920s, they did move into soup specifically.
Right.
So it was Ethel who's credited for creating the first Baxter soup in 1929.
I mean, I would say
mm-hmm.
that Baxter's has always been making soup.
Yeah.
For as long back as their records will show, soups, all kinds.
Soups, all kinds has been part of their offering. It's such an interesting, and this is part of the like difficulty of the food historian, because you're sort of weaving through these different sides of the story.
Yeah.
And you wonder, maybe they were just doing soups of all kinds. Maybe this was the first time they did like a Baxter soup.
Absolutely. So much of what we do sometimes, especially when we're talking about companies that are alive and well today,
mm-hmm.
is that they have stories that have been presented in the last 50 years
mm-hmm.
by marketing agencies, by companies, and also just by the way that the family tells the story.
Yeah.
And when that is kind of built into their marketing and how they talk about themselves, it can be kind of solidified as history.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes a wee note on the bottom of a thing that says soups all kinds back in 1881.
Yeah, you're like, okay, well, it wasn't the 1920s where you first started making soup.
But it definitely is actually, it's not a negative, it's a plus.
It's just
part of the story.
And it shows that it's like built on, it wasn't just a eureka moment for someone one day. It was like built on previous knowledge. I think it might have been their first time they decided to like brand yes. it Baxter's themselves. Soup. It was yeah. like Baxter's soup. And interestingly, it is that kind of, it's not an invention, it's an innovation, it's built on years of work. But what I did find interesting was the first flavor of soup
okay.
that they branded as Baxter soup.
What is it?
Royal Game.
Okay, yeah.
So it was like a soup made from, entirely from Scottish game, apparently. Yeah. So mainly venison, but also like pheasant and maybe some partridge.
Yep.
And it was, yeah, they're guaranteed made entirely from Scotch game. And that was their whole selling point. So even here we have like a, so this is 1920s. We have an interesting like emphasis on the Scottishness of the ingredients, yeah. which I think is points to the fact that they're probably like, you could probably get a Baxter's tin of soup in a Fortnum and Mason, you know, camper.
That's my Paisley accent's crawling at you. My first thought was actually about thinking back to when Macon was telling us about the history of whiskey advertising and the way that there was this new kind of, again, in the 1920s, it's not that far away from Empire exhibitions as well, that there's yeah. this notion of the romantic Scotland is being exported around the world. And actually, I think to position yourself in the market as a luxury Highland game soup producer, it's a very smart move.
Yeah,
for massively. This time specifically.
Absolutely. I think it was, you're tying into the sort of the leisure, the travel. It's like, come up here and get a taste of Scotland, you yeah. know, especially again, like I think whilst the location of Baxter's isn't like clearly tied to any kind of industry, the one industry it is tied to is whiskey.
Yeah.
So you have that kind of potentially people being up on tours for distilleries.
Yeah.
And it's that Highland package that you're selling them. So this, yeah, this Highland game, or Royal Game Soup, rather. Not Highland Game, Royal Game Soup, mm-hmm. was the first one that they did. And that was apparently, although we've had soups of all kinds, but apparently that was a soup journey beginning.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, then, as you would expect, you have, like, the war happening. And I think, perhaps unlike Tunnocks, I keep comparing them, but I think I've just, in my mind, I've got these two, like, dynastic Scottish food families, like, on similar timelines. And it's interesting just sort of seeing how they existed in similar and different ways. Unlike Tunnocks, Baxter's were in a really good stead for the war because they were already making preserved provisions.
So because that's the very interesting thing about World War II for Baxter's, mm-hmm. is that George passes away between the wars.
Yeah.
And so while you have seen out World War I, you now are facing another war, but without your family leader.
Yeah, the sort of kingpin.
And I don't know necessarily what, you know, he had in the way of like the control in the company or the way that he was kind of operating in the business.
No, I mean, by this point, I think Ethel and William were very much the kind of like at the forefront of things. He was maybe just overseeing it. But yeah, it's still like the loss of the person who started everything.
That heritage, the family history. Yeah. I do think when we see, and we're having spoken to people that take on family companies, on one side, there's a relief where you don't have to double check everything that you're doing. You're in charge. But that's also an enormously lonely place for lots of people to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because suddenly all of it's on you.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to be the one that has the wisdom now.
And I think that must be such pressure. And like Tunnocks, Baxter's is a company that still has a member of the family at its like head. I can't imagine the pressure out of that kind of thing. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Like all that history kind of on your shoulders, like having to be the person that, and especially with this kind of business that changes generationally, but also in reaction to markets. Like it's the Baxter's that is now is very different to what was back then, obviously. And now it's a far more global corporation. And that's because they've adapted. But like having to continually do that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never felt that kind of family pressure. It must be pretty tough.
I have. No, I haven't. But let's come back and we'll chat about World War II. So it feels like World War II was actually, one, an interesting time for tinned food, because I assume that there is a market now, really, for tinned food in a way that there wasn't before the war, when rationing comes in and our food system is beginning to get organised and people only have access to certain foods. The other side of that is you also have a massive competition that comes in from America.
Yep.
And things like Spam.
Yep.
And evaporated milk and all sorts of kind of American tinned inventions are now being hailed as the saviour of Britain. Exactly. Where does Baxter's fit into that?
I mean, so I've read that Baxter's, you know, they stayed open. They didn't suffer in terms of business. The business model changed, but it was very much about supplying the armed forces, I think. They were sent, particularly jam. They were sending jam to the armed forces.
Well, with trade so disrupted, you know, before they're doing canned pineapples and syrup.
Yeah.
I don't think you would have that level of trusted supply chain.
No, exactly.
To get exotic foods. So you're definitely going to look at what's closer to home.
You're shrinking back into the local, doing what you can. And because you have the technology in place to actually make this stuff, I think that was what they did. It was like, okay, back to what we can do within the local area. And yeah, that was how they stayed afloat, basically.
And I wouldn't be surprised if they still have game and they still have
I think you could still make a lot of soups. You could still be doing like tinned vegetables of kinds. But yeah, certainly it's not a period where you're focusing on like the new thing. It's like, okay, how we're keeping afloat
and
feeding people. Exactly. Yeah. And the war was a very interesting time for tins. And again, as you said, because of the nature of like tins could come from anywhere, your competitors are global. Yeah. Like, this is a kind of new age of food market where it's not just the other butchers down the road that you have to compete with. It's like the whole world. So having a product that people trust, I think that's really important. And that was something that a company like Baxter's had really established because of their kind of the fact that it was a recognizable name in the local area and across Britain would have done wonders. Whereas something comes in from the States, people might not know it.
Yeah.
You kind of want to have that comforting edge, I think.
But there was such a big push. So there was a thing called the lease loan, which came from America, where they essentially said, we're not getting involved in the war, but what we're going to do for our allied nations. We're
going to send you chocolates and tights.
We're going to send you things that are like, we'll ask for it back. It's a lease and you'll replace these goods at somewhere down the field. And the big things that came into British grocery stores were powdered eggs, tinned meats, evaporated milk and dried fruits.
Yep.
And they were sold under this kind of very exotic banner, but also being sold like, if you buy sausages from your butcher, they're probably 40% meat.
Yeah.
Where Spam is 100% meat with salt and oil or something.
Yeah.
And there was a big campaign because
they're playing upon the, like, ironically enough, they're playing upon the initial fears that haunted tinned foods, which was like adulteration and weird things. We don't know what it is. So they're like taking that narrative and using it to their advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't trust what's in a sausage. You can trust Spam.
I think I love Spam, but I wouldn't say I could really tell you what was in it.
I don't know if I've ever had Spam.
I have a tin in the kitchen. I can go and fry some up right now.
I'm okay. Thank you very much, Lindsay. I do remember corned beef a lot as a child, and that it was borderline scarring. Like, it was just, and again, I don't, it was like leftover like corned beef.
Yeah.
And from a tin that just kind of gloops. It was not my favorite thing.
No.
It was probably served with like boiled potatoes. Well, this and is boiled why cabbage. You hate
Stovies, right?
Because of the corned beef. Yeah, because
it was corned beef.
But if anyone would like to try and change my mind about Spam,
it's good. It's really good. But anyway, so we have the war.
Anyway, we have the war. Fast forward.
Move on. Like that little squeaky noise. And what happens where we have the sons of Ethel and William, Gordon and Ian, and they've taken over the Baxter's company and they're keeping it running. But what happens that is critical to the company, again, is one of the Baxter sons marries a smart and innovative woman.
Everywhere we turn.
What are these companies doing without these gals?
I know.
Like, dead in the war.
these women of empire and industry.
They're, this is where the brain's
backbone of innovation.
So Ina Robertson, I'm presuming it's Ina Robertson. She was an artist and also a cook, and she grew up in Huntly, which is very close to Fockburs, again, in Aberdeenshire. And she married Gordon in 1952. So
is this the Ina that writes the book?
Yes, it is indeed.
Oh, there it is next to me.
Hey! This is the very Ina Baxter of your book, but Nee Robertson, that was her name before she was married.
I would have said Ina.
Ina, do you think?
Well, you say Ina, I'll say Ina, just to cover bases.
But what was really interesting to me about her was she was an artist and she trained at Gray's School of Art, which is like Aberdeen's art school.
Yeah.
Due to the war, she'd ended up having to sack that off, and she worked at the Ministry of Food. And she was working at the Ministry of Food at the Torrey Research Station based in Aberdeen.
Yeah.
So she has this kind of scientific interest in food. It wasn't just that she was a cook, but she was also working on things like fish processing, canning, dehydration, quick freezing. She was like at the kind of technological forefront of food.
A food technologist.
Exactly. She was a food technologist. So then life goes its certain ways, as it does, but this is what she's been doing during the war. She's been learning all these things about food. She ends up moving to Fockburs to teach art because the war's over, and, you know, maybe getting a job as a teacher was easier for a woman than...
And there was probably a man that came back.
Aye, he's like, go away now. Thank you.
For giving my seat warm. Yeah.
Exactly. So she moved to Fockburs. She was teaching art, and that was where she met Gordon Baxter, who she, of course, went on to marry. And I love that she brought like not only her expertise around food and her artistic flair, but like that scientific technical expertise to the factory. And this seems to be a real turning point for the company.
Every time we talk, I'm just like, this would make a great series.
I know. You could, it would be a disservice, but you could have like a Netflix series that was like one episode on each of these, like.
But this is the thing of showing the, like, it's like the model of the crowd.
Yeah.
To show the beginning, the middle, and the present day, to kind of show the way that time has passed and the just how remarkable food can be. The theme of food business, food entrepreneurialism. Shut up, Peter. Food enterprise, like the life and death decisions that people are making every day to feed a nation, I think is a fascinating. And Anna, a food technologist.
Yes.
That moves to Falkabers to teach art, who ends up becoming the cover girl of Baxter's Food through her soon-to-be published cookery book.
So I love that when she gets there, she marries Gordon. She obviously is like quick to suss out what things are. Yeah. But the first range of soups that she puts her name to is a Scotch range. And it's like they do their cockaliki, their Scotch broth, their lentil, Cullen skink. And the whole thing was she designed the cover of the tins. They were very much like plaid, tartan, your kind of like romantic Scottish scene of the Highlands.
Yeah.
But it was about traditional Scottishness. So even at that point, I mean, we're now in the sort of 1950s, 60s.
Yeah.
But she's like, okay, this is how we brand. We're turning to tradition. And Peter has on his lap one of her cookbooks.
So this was 1974.
Mm-hmm.
1974.
We'll go for Anna. Sorry. Let's go for it.
Baxter's, if you're listening to this, I apologize profusely. I'm going to go with Anna. Anna Baxter's Scottish Cookbook. And in it, it's like it has a wee bit about her life and her childhood, really qualifying why she's written this cookbook. And obviously it's an industry plant. It's designed to raise the profile of Baxter's. But she does open it by talking about her history and the history of Baxter's. And then goes into soups and has a map of Scotland and very much cementing Baxter's as the height of Scottish food.
Yeah. And by that point, that was the aim, I think. That was the clear thing that they were aiming for. But what was fascinating to me, particularly given like we know that Baxter's is prolific as a brand, you know, even at that, when you're that 1880s advert, you can see they're sending things all around the country.
Yeah.
But in the 1940s, they only had 11 employees.
Wow.
So it's still a tiny company.
And I suppose that's the privilege of mechanization.
Yeah, it's 11 employees and a big old factory.
Yeah.
So you're still like churning things out. But by the early 2000s, there's over 950 employees.
Right.
So this is a period where Anna is kind of at the head that Baxter's kind of explodes in terms of profit, in terms of how they employ, in terms of what they're producing. It's then that they solidify themselves as a brand to be contended with. In 1955, they got a royal warrant from the Queen to like be the purveyors of like Scottish fine tin soups. So, I mean,
all kinds.
All kinds. Such a good motto. Yeah, soups, all kinds. it was this point, and I like to think that she had the perfect like cocktail of like being an artist, having the food technology, being a scientist, being like a cook, just like took the whole model.
A real food renaissance woman.
Exactly. So, I mean, I've read in... There's some great quotes from Anna. She says, "I've spent half my life reading recipes and the other half walking from the office to my home and back again in Wellington boots." But then it also talks about how difficult it was and how hard it was on their relationship and just like clearly quite a difficult life to lead to be the head of that kind of empire. Apparently her first soup was a gumbo.
Yeah.
and she'd made it not as a tin soup, but made it for her husband, and had to look up what okra was, mm-hmm. or okra, and been like, okay, well, I'm not going to get that in Fockabers, so I'll use green beans instead.
Yeah.
And the recipe was so impressive that her husband was like, we need to tin this. And it took her several attempts to get it right just because of different ingredients. Obviously, you need to like cook them at different times, yeah. because otherwise they go mushy. Like, it's a yeah. it's a really difficult technology.
Yeah.
And apparently her inspiration to keep going came from she'd watched a documentary about Marie Curie and her like several failed attempts to discover radium. She's like, I must keep going with my soup, and got there.
This, I mean, it's now a Netflix series with a comedy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, just, I love the kind of, you get a sense of that kind of drive behind her, behind the brand. I mean, what kind of thing is in her cookbook?
I mean,
what is it called?
It's called Enna Baxter's Scottish Cookbook.
Nice.
The thing that I find very interesting, and what I've looked through, I have not seen any Baxter's products. There's an entire selection of baked goods mm-hmm. in here, including Fockabers gingerbread and oatmeal raisin puffs, griddle scones, all that sort of stuff. And then towards the front is where we have our savouries, and we have like bashed neeps, gamekeeper's stew, we have a grouse pudding, scallops, mutton pies. Nowhere in here have I yet seen add one tin of Baxter's soup.
I mean, surely.
But I do feel like, again, there's a big picture of Baxter's products on the back page that has all the tins in amongst the salmon and the side of wheat and all this stuff. But this on the front, you would not buy this because it's... But I wonder, again, if that's very intentional.
Deliberate. They made it about her as a woman, as a figurehead.
And her expertise in food history.
Yeah, yeah.
And in capturing Scottish food that... As a market, if to be very shallow and say this is just a marketing ploy, I think there's probably a bit of this, which is her own passion as a food technologist.
Absolutely.
And being able to create something which might be slightly outside of the company.
Yeah.
We'll say that. The other side, maybe it's a shallow marketing ploy to try and raise the name of Baxter's, but it does so.
It does it, and it does it gracefully.
It does. Yeah. And you will find Enna Baxter's cookery books all over the world.
Yeah.
And again, it's quite a small book, kind of... gift book size. Mm-hmm. And again, I've seen recipes on like Scottish food, like Facebook pages and things from all over the world, from Australia, from Canada, from America, all from Enna Baxter's cookbook. I wonder if it was tied in that kind of early millennium expansion, if that expansion was into places like Walmart, Walgreens, into these places, big chain supermarkets, and whether this book was part of displays or was tied to that expansion.
I mean, in the 1990s, that was when like Enna kind of took a step back in terms of like driving things forward. It went to other people, eventually ended up with Audrey Baxter, who's the current Baxter at the head of things. But what was really interesting then was the fact that the business changed to kind of acquiring other food businesses around the world.
Okay.
So that was the business model in terms of expanding. They, you know, they now sell all over the world, but they, you know, apparently there's been over like 170 bids to take Baxter's over, but they've kept it in the family, and instead they've kind of expanded outwards. So they've, they now own Frey Bentos. And they so they have a range of like Frey Bentos inspired Baxter soups, which I didn't know. But they've kept the Frey Bentos brand, and there's other they've bought a lot of different businesses that they've kind of just taken in the same manner, I suppose, as like Cadbury's or.
But you do find in a lot of historic products, I'm thinking about like Atora.
Yes.
I think about things like Brown and Poulsen. I think about some of these historic products which are still being manufactured today, but they have been bought over so many times that there's nobody in the business, like it's Premier Foods or whatever it is, that now
that
owns lots
history.
Of these. Yeah. And nobody knows the history. Biro is owned. And there's a sad little website for Biro with an order link form for a cookbook.
Yep.
And nothing about the community history, the food history, the way that these companies have shaped our understanding of ourselves and our food and our family memories and all these sorts of bits and pieces.
Yep.
So, yeah, of course, there is part of it which is about the emotional decision of keeping a family business within the family.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there is a something wider there.
Exactly. And I think, so I find the Frey Bentos thing to be quite an interesting example, because that's another like iconic British brand. But if you're on the Baxter's website, it's like Frey Bentos is an iconic British brand, and they've kept the brand integrity, and they're still like presenting the history of it. So it's not just that they've swallowed the products and like, this is ours and this has always been ours.
Yeah.
They're retaining that familiarity and also the kind of heritage of it. So it seems like a really nice way of doing that kind of expansion, where you recognize that you're the kind of, you're the stronghold, or you want to be the stronghold in this industry. As a result, you need to absorb other businesses that are doing the same, but you retain that dignity for yourself and also for them, which seems nice.
I do wonder if that's like the guiding principle.
Mm.
Because the private sector, the main drive is maximizing profit.
Yeah.
But keeping a family company as a family company, acquiring other brands and preserving their heritage, I wonder if there is something else at work here.
Yeah.
Whether they have a personal family, you know, ethical code about preserving heritage.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. George's motto was be different, be better. And I feel like that maybe stands in that kind of ethos of value selling, but...
Yeah. I know that's true. Value is a very good word to describe what it is.
Mm.
If they were going to create a Scottish food history line of soups for Baxter's, let's come up with three soups. One for you, one for me, and one we do together.
Okay. I would like a sort of like hodgepodge. I would like a hodgepodge soup.
What is that?
So hodgepodge is just like a kind of stew, potatoy, muttony type thing.
Okay, right, okay.
And I just love saying it.
Hodgepodge.
Yeah.
One of the best soups I've ever had was at a Scouts Hall in the Borders. And it was pea and pear.
Oh.
With a chicken, or no, a vegetable stock.
Yum.
And I've never eaten something like it.
Pear? Was it like puree?
Tinned pears,
mm-hmm.
cooked with peas and in a vegetable stock.
Okay.
Onions.
Mm-hmm.
And then, blitzed and served.
That sounds divine.
It's actually one of those like really fantastic summer recipes.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, if we were going to do one together, I would say like a fresh pea veloute type vibe. But you've done it.
Right.
With pears.
We need to have one between us. What's a really Scottish? Maybe it's not a soup.
Mm.
Maybe our third tin is a fish tin.
A fish tin, yes.
A line of like a hot smoked sardine.
Baxter's. Oh, if Baxter's want to develop like a lovely box tinned, of tinned fishes.
Tinned fish range. At Baxter's, we'll do 90% of it for free. We just want, we'll do it for free,
all
but with
marketing.
A profit share. Yeah.
I've already got the tattoo. Like, we are there
for you. Yeah. Oh,
stunning. So Audrey Baxter is the current Baxter in helm of the company, still very much keeping it in the family. Although I think, as with all these things, it probably gets harder and harder with each generation to like be like, okay, yeah, I'm going to stay doing this. But they continue to be growing internationally, and they sell in like all over the world, and it just seems to be a brand that's smashing it.
Yeah. It's another story about
women taking the frickin' charge.
Women being absolute bosses.
Yeah.
In crafting the food of our nation.
The food of our nation, the kind of innovations that went behind it, the art, the way it's presented, like all angles here are coming from the
women. I wonder if George, the gardener.
Yeah.
In Moray.
Where? Yeah.
Could have seen into the future to see that his name and his motto and the seeds that he started as preserved meats, soup, all kinds, would have blossomed into what is now Baxter's of Scotland.
A global brand, yeah.
What a great Scot.
A great Scot indeed. This podcast was hosted by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist and was produced and edited by Ken McKitchen.
Yeah, that'll do.